Very good to see all of you here for the Bible study, our first Bible study of 2005. We are getting into the book of Daniel this evening. We've been, of course, going through a series on the writings, and we went through Psalms, Proverbs, and Job in some detail. And then we have been more recently in the five festival scrolls of Song of Solomon, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. Now, actually, the book of Daniel is included in with the writings. It is the next book we would come to in terms of the writings. Now, we have already gone through earlier in the inspired order. The book of Daniel is followed by Ezra, Nehemiah, and then the book of Chronicles. And those represent the post-exilic books, the books that were written after the exile. When we went through the historical survey of the Old Testament, we went through Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles at that time, just sort of following through the story flow. So we will not go back through them, but rather when we conclude the book of Daniel, we're going to do Daniel in two sections, and when we conclude the book of Daniel, then we will get directly into the minor prophets and do a series on the 12 minor prophets. But I want us to look a little bit at Daniel and to understand that initially the background of the book. Daniel, of course, was taken captive. One of the great pivot points in the history of ancient Israel and Judah was, of course, the captivity and the destruction of Jerusalem. That was such a very major point, right on the par with the events, you know, the Exodus in a positive way, the entrance into the promised land, the establishment of the kingdom. But at this point, we have God's judgment that has come on the nation, and it came progressively. You know, it's interesting how many times there are patterns of three in terms of finality. We find that there were three invasions and three captivities of Judah. The first is the one that Daniel was taken captive in. We know when this occurred. It was the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged the city. And Nebuchadnezzar did not destroy the city at that time. He made it a tributary state, and he took Daniel and a number of other young Jewish lads as captives to Babylon. And one of Nebuchadnezzar's ideas was to build a sort of a professional civil service in Babylon, composed of not just the sons of wealthy, influential people in Babylon, but rather his policy was that as his empire expanded, he selected out some of the what seemed to him to be, or to his top generals, the most promising young men. And they selected them out, and they brought them to Babylon, and they entered this sort of training school or college, whatever you want to call it, in which they were instructed in the Chaldean language and in various other things relating to, let's say, education as it stood in ancient Babylon. And there were examinations, just as you have in the civil service exam, and those who scored high were given higher jobs and had opportunity to work their way up. One of the reasons that Nebuchadnezzar, in that sense, was successful. Now, one of the other factors along that line that was in common with most of the kingdoms of the East, you know, they were always worried that some of the ones who were down the ladder, you know, some of the civil servants, some of the administrators, would wind up wanting to advance themselves and their family and their dynasty rather than advancing the king. I see that's always a problem, that people have families and their children grow up, and well, they want to advance their sons, want to see their sons advance. And so the king, not only of Babylon, but of most of those areas of the East, had a solution for that that persisted in some areas of the East all the way down to modern times. And that was the fact that those in the civil service had no children to advance. That's why you find the term eunuch became almost synonymous with servant in terms of the king's court. Now, not that every single one was, and in some cases the term eunuch came to be sort of a generic term applied to civil servants, but so I don't know that you can prove the matter entirely, but one of the things that it is, that was a custom. The eunuchs were not only used to guard the king's harem, but that was the other factor of it. And of course, the civil servants were continually going and coming from the palace, which is where the harem was. So the king had his ways of sort of assuring some of those things. So we find that Daniel and his friends were delivered to Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, and so that certainly gives rise to the idea that this is what happened to Daniel and his friends. One of the things I think, as we go through the book of Daniel, I'd like to go through it on a couple of different levels. One, on the personal level, because the book tells the story of Daniel. Secondly, on a different level, a prophetic level. One of the remarkable things, you know, the book of Daniel stands out in a way that is different from the other prophetic books in the Old Testament. It is the most like the book of Revelation. Most of the prophetic books in the Old Testament, or virtually all of them, as we will see when we go on through the minor prophets, they are arranged usually in the order that certain prophecies were given. Usually the formula is, you know, the word of the Lord came unto so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, in such and such a year, and then it records the prophecy, the statement. And then a little later, the word of the Lord came again unto so-and-so, and it may be a year later or 6 months later or whatever it is. And what you find is in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and in mostly in the minor prophets, the prophecies are arranged in the order in which they were received. That's what you generally find. And they were grouped not by subject so much as by the revelation that God gave at a particular time. Now, Daniel arranges itself that way, but one of the things that Daniel does in Daniel 2 and in Daniel 7 in a very special way is he starts in his day. He makes it very plain that he's starting in his day, the days of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And he runs a successive prophecy all the way until the time when the God of heaven sets up a kingdom. Now, understand that the problem that's created in the other prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the minor prophets, you can go through and read a lot of different prophecies. The trouble is that if it weren't for other books in the Bible, you wouldn't know how those prophecies related to one another in terms of time sequence, which event happened here, and then what came next and what came next, because they're not arranged in a sequential order. Now, you know, the idea in the ancient world was, of course, that there were many gods. And each nation had its own gods, and they worshipped, this god or that god, sort of their national god. And the rulers of the Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, were willing to let the other nations worship their gods. In fact, they were generally willing to accept the fact, well, yes, you know, you're gods. But then, see, if we went to war with you and we won the war, then obviously our gods are stronger than your gods. So you can keep worshiping yours, but you got to worship ours too. And the fact that we went to war, I won and you lost, that proves that my God is stronger than your God. And so what do you find when Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem? Remember when he finally destroyed the temple? And even before then, he had looted the place, and he brought treasures of the temple, and he put them in the temple of his God there in Babylon. You see, the idea was he had carried off trophies, and his God was the winner. I mean, that was the way he looked at it, and the way most did. And so he brought in, generally from most of these nations, when they conquered them, these nations would have their temple with their idol that they worshipped. They would normally bring the idol and set it up there in the temple there in Babylon. And so it was sort of a trophy, you know. But, of course, they didn't have any statue or anything like that to bring from to bring from Jerusalem. And there's no evidence whatsoever that they brought the Ark of the Covenant. What happened to it is, of course, a matter of speculation because the Bible doesn't say. I think we know that... See, we have a list of the things that they brought, and the Ark isn't mentioned. That would have been the most valuable thing. I mean, we know they brought the pillars of brass in front of the temple, and they brought various things, but they didn't. The Ark is never mentioned as having been brought. There's no Jewish tradition that it was brought. Later, when Cyrus allowed Ezra to take things back, Cyrus allowed Zerubbabel to take certain things back, and later Artaxerxes allowed Ezra to take the rest of it. There's no mention of the Ark. There was not an Ark of the Covenant in the Second Temple. The Holy of Holies was empty. That's one of the three things that were missing from the Second Temple that were present in Solomon's Temple, the Ark of the Covenant. God allowed the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem and to destroy the temple. He did not allow them to take the Ark of the Covenant, symbolic of His presence. He did not allow them to have that as a trophy. Now, where it went and who hid it, they're varying traditions. I would suspect that Jeremiah, who was a priest as well as a prophet, was probably responsible for overseeing the removal of the Ark. And whether it's hidden in Ireland, as some traditions hold, or whether it's hidden, in some secret cavern on Mount Moriah in the General Temple complex, whether it's hidden somewhere else, I don't know. But I suspect that in God's time, we'll find that it still exists. Daniel, nevertheless, is brought there. So we get back that in the midst of all of this, one of the things God gave Daniel was the fact that God was still in charge. That it wasn't just He was the God of Judah or the God of Israel. He was the God of the whole world, and He could foresee and could declare the rise and fall of the Gentile powers. And that all of these nations, these Gentile powers, their empires would ebb and flow. They were temporary. And eventually the God of heaven was going to set up a kingdom that would never be removed. And so that story runs through. Now, when you start out here in the book of Daniel, the first thing we're introduced to, just on a personal level, Daniel is taken. This is about 604 B.C. when he and his friends are selected, or at least are among the group that is selected, and they're brought back to Babylon. And the king, you see, he's going to really be generous. He wants them well educated. They're going to be housed there in an annex to the palace, and they're going to be fed with the king's food. Boy, it doesn't get any better than that, right? Well, not if you like shrimp and oysters and pork chops and all the rest of it. It was a lot of things that the king ate. And so the very first test, they were probably on army rations on the way back from on the way back, and that would have been grains and dried fruits and cheeses and things that would make a long trip. But when they got back there, and in effect, the announcement was made, well, you boys are really lucky. The king is going to let you eat what he eats. Daniel, of course, knew what that meant. And so here he is faced with a problem. And he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself, verse 8, with this portion of the king's meat or the wine that he drank. Understand that the wine normally was one of the objections that the Jews had to that. Was normally the first libation of the vintage was poured out to one of the various gods, and it was considered offered to idols. And that being the case, well, it was like an idolatrous ceremony. Of course, a lot of the meat would have been as well. So we find that Daniel made a request that he could be excused from eating this. God had brought him into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Now, think about it from Daniel's perspective. You know, you and I don't really get to choose most of our trials in life. Now, sometimes we choose a trial by doing something stupid and, bringing some consequence on ourselves, and I guess in that sense we get to choose it. But a lot of times, things happen. How do you handle it? You know, Daniel and his friends were taken here to Babylon. You think Daniel and his friends were the worst kids in Jerusalem, and that's why they got jerked away from their families and hauled off? No. In fact, as you read the story, they must have been some of the best kids in Jerusalem. You know, it's easy to understand when bad things happen to bad people. That makes sense. But the trouble, of course, is sometimes understanding why bad things happen to people who are trying to do what was right. So here we find Daniel removed from his family, removed from his homeland, transported into a new place, and, he's made friends of the man that has oversight of him. But who is this fellow? The prince of the eunuchs. That'd be wonderful news if you're a young fellow to hear that that's who you're being delivered to. You look at it from a standpoint, put yourself in Daniel's standpoint. The trouble you and I have sometimes with that is we've already read the whole book. We know how it ends up. Here's this great righteous man. Well, no, actually at this point, here's this 15, 16-year-old boy who has been uprooted from everything and must have been as mystified as to why all this was happening to him. Well, he could probably think of various people that he knew back in Jerusalem that were a whole lot worse than he was, that they didn't get hauled off to Babylon. But notice his attitude. You know, Daniel at this point clearly could not have understood the why behind everything he was going through. But what he did know was that he believed in God, and he believed in God's law. And he didn't want to break God's law. And so this, in a sense, was the first test. See, here was a test of Daniel's commitment and his attitude. And, the prince of the eunuchs basically told him, verse 10, I like you, but I fear the king. you're a nice boy, and I like you, but, the king, he's got quite a temper, and he told me what to feed you, and he looks at you, and you look worse than the others, and then he finds out that I didn't follow his instructions. I mean, I'm a dead man. And so Daniel then does not stop there. He goes to Melzar, the specific man that the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel. And he makes him a deal. He says, look, give us 10 days. Give us fruits and vegetables. Give us whole grain. Give us water. And then let's compare us to the others. And so, king's not going to check on anybody in the next 10 days. So he consented, said, we'll do it for 10 days. Well, at the end of 10 days, they were looking better and healthier than everybody else. You can imagine, these others. Number one, they were probably had food they'd never seen before. They had been on the trail from wherever they had been taken captive all the way back to Babylon. They get here, they've been on sort of army rations for a period of weeks. Now, it's sort of the all-you-can-eat buffet that is set out there. So what do? They gorge themselves on it. What happens? Well, they get sick, they eat a bunch of rich stuff, their faces breaking out, they're just, eating all sorts of things. So Daniel and his friends, they look healthy. Well, the Melzar said, okay, well, that's good enough for me. You boys are healthier than the rest of them, so you can have what you want. Well, now, in the aftermath of this, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. God then, see, they took a step of showing their commitment and their loyalty to God. God then, they were capable, talented young fellows to begin with, but God just gave them that sort of extra amount. And Daniel had particular understanding in terms of visions and dreams. Well, we find that when all was said and done, the latter part of chapter 1 just gives a summary that when finally they came to the end of their 3 years and their time of examination, nobody could stand up to the four of them. And Daniel continued a very lengthy time all the way down past the fall of Babylon, the time of King Cyrus. Well, chapter 2 picks it up about a year after Daniel and his friends had been there. This was the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He dreamed a dream, and his spirit was very troubled, and he called for the magicians, and he called for the astrologers, and he called for all the people that were supposed to know all this stuff, and he said, I want you to tell me what I dreamed and what it meant. Well, we've gone over this particular thing a number of times, and of course, you know, they weren't able to do that. They told him, they said, well, if you'll tell us what you dreamed, we can tell you what it meant. And the king said, oh, no, you don't. If you can tell me what it means, you ought to be able to tell me what I dreamed. And they said, well, nobody can do that. And Nebuchadnezzar said, fine, I'll chop you all up into little pieces and tear your house down. So he was worse than the big bad wolf of the story. And the king was angry, verse 12, and very furious. So word went out, and Daniel, of course, heard about it, and this would have applied to him. And Daniel told the captain of the king's guard, he said, look, what's going on? And it was explained to him. And Daniel then let it be known that he would show the king the interpretation. Went to his house and made the thing known to his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. Then we find the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. You know, at the time Daniel volunteered, he didn't know the answer. He stepped out on faith. And Daniel, of course, was very thankful. And He noted here in verse 21 about God that he changed the times and the seasons, he removes kings and sets up kings, gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge to them that no understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. You know, God is the source of knowledge. So when Daniel came into the king, he answered here in verse 27, you know, that the secret you've required, nobody around you has been able to tell. Verse 28, but there is a God in heaven that reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. So we notice a couple of things. One, it's emphasized right from the beginning that the God of heaven is the one who reveals secrets. He is the one who has knowledge. And Daniel made this point to King Nebuchadnezzar. You know, Nebuchadnezzar had enough problem with pride anyway, and he had defeated Judah. And he needed to be reminded, and the Babylonian Empire that ruled over Judah needed to be reminded that their victory was not because of God's weakness. It was because of Judah's sin and God allowing them to go into captivity. Another thing we find right here, when is this prophecy for? Verse 28, what shall be in the latter days? So here's a prophecy for the end time, not just for ancient history. So Daniel then describes to him what he saw, a great image, and he describes this great bright image, and it was very awe-inspiring. The head was of fine gold, and the chest and the silver and the arms were silver, the belly and the thighs were brass, and the legs of iron, and the feet were part of iron and part of clay. And the last thing that he saw was a stone of supernatural origin, a stone that was cut out without hands, that smote the image upon his feet, the feet of iron and clay, and it broke them to pieces. And the whole thing then became like chaff and blew away. Now this is the dream, verse 36, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. He said, so Daniel then explains to him in the end of verse 38, you are this head of gold. So he describes the great empire of Babylon. So we know the starting point. You know, one of the things, people just jump around on prophecy and anything that happens. Boy, they'll, that's talking about this. I remember years ago back, the beast is described as, in Revelation, as a scarlet-colored beast. Well, those of you who remember back to the 60s remember, in the 50s and 60s, that the communists were the enemy. And what did we call the communists? The Reds. So just about any preacher that preached on prophecy, you know, if he was going to preach on prophecy, well, this was world communism. That was the beast. Well, where did they get that? Well, they just sort of grabbed it out of the air. You see, what we're given here is a progression. We know when we start. We start with the head of gold that represented Babylon in Daniel's day. That's the starting point. You don't have to guess. It says so right here. What is the ending? Well, it's when the God of heaven sets up a kingdom that'll never be removed. That is described on down here in verse 44. So everything that happens, happens in a period of a little over 26 centuries. And, most of us are familiar with computers. Let me throw out an analogy for you. We all wonder, you know, how close are we to the end? Well, from the days, if you're looking at this image, you know how sometimes somebody sends you a picture on the computer, and if you got particularly something slow like mine, it just seems like it goes on and on, it's downloading, and you see the little bar flash up there, and the percentage that you downloaded, and you sit there and you wait, and finally, 100% download. Well, we know when this started. See, it started 26 centuries ago, about 600 B.C. And if this was a computer image, then what you'd have to say is it's a little over, it's probably 99% plus downloaded. Because if you've got 26 centuries, 26 years is 1%, right? So, however close to the end, we're probably at least 99% downloaded on this image. You hadn't quite got to where the stone smashes the feet, but that's getting close. You know, the image is almost totally downloaded. And anyway, Daniel goes through and he explains that this is a succession of kingdoms, and this is made very plain in verse 40. The fourth kingdom. See, in verse 39, after you, he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar, shall arise another kingdom inferior to you, and another third kingdom of brass, which will bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Well, it's pretty plain, you know. You just go through history. The book of Daniel records the first succession as we go from Babylon to Persia. A couple of hundred years later brings you down to the Greek Empire, and then we know that Rome swallowed the whole thing up. And then we come down to the toes that were part of iron and part of clay, partly strong, partly broken. It is not a it is not a cohesive mixture, but it's not going to mix well, but it will mix for a little while. And in the days of these final ten kings, God sets up a kingdom. And Nebuchadnezzar, of course, is really overcome by all this. He's just so impressed. Nobody's been able to tell him. And he, verse 46, falls on his face and worships Daniel and commands that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors to him like he was a god. And he says, your God is a God of gods. So he made Daniel a great man, gave him many gifts. And Daniel, of course, requested that his three friends be given responsibility as well. Well, did Nebuchadnezzar really get the point? No. You get into chapter 3. What did he do? Next thing we read is Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. This huge image that he sets up. And evidently it was gold plate. I mean, when you look at the size of the image, but it was a colossal image nevertheless. Had a golden appearance. set up there in the plains of there in the outskirts of Babylon. And he is going to have this great ceremony, and everybody, at least all of the leadership, everybody who is anybody, is invited to the party. The orchestra is going to strike up the band, and everybody bows down to the image. Well, you know the story. There were some folks that were standing by. You know, they were jealous of Daniel and his friends. Now, we're not told where Daniel was. He's not in this story. So he's evidently somewhere else. But his three friends were there. And so they were in the group. And some of the Chaldeans came, these astrologers. And they said, "Now, King, didn't you make this decree? Everybody's supposed to bow down." "Oh, yes, that's the decree he made." He said, "Well, there are some Jews that you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they don't serve your gods, and they don't worship the golden image. Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be brought." And so they came, and he said, "You know what? I've heard you don't serve my gods. Now, I'm going to give you boys one more chance. And if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the music, you can bow down and worship the image, but if not, I'm going to throw you in the midst of a burning fiery furnace, and who is the God that can deliver you out of my hand?" Now, that is not a real smart question to ask, you know, because you may get an answer to it. Nebuchadnezzar was about to get the answer. He found out, as you go through the story, you find that one of the besetting problems of Nebuchadnezzar was pride. So he learns that at the height of his empire building, that the God of heaven has already decreed the rise and fall of nations. You know, if you were just looking at it from a human standpoint, it would seem that Babylon was just going to be on the scene indefinitely. But Daniel was already giving God's pronouncement that it was coming to an end. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "We don't need to take time to think this over. Our God, whom we serve," verse 17, "is able to deliver us." You ask the question, who's able to? Our God is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. "And he will deliver us out of your hand." See, they didn't know one way or the other they were going to be delivered. Either delivered from the furnace or certainly delivered out of Nebuchadnezzar's hand, because if they died, what was going to happen to them? Well, the next split second of their consciousness, they were going to be in the resurrection. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is full of fury. And boy, he gets mad. You know, he sort of liked these boys up until then. Now he's really mad. And he commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more. Now, if you've ever seen pictures of these were the great smelting furnaces there on the plains of Babylon. And they had a hand-operated bellows, a clay pipe that came into the furnace through which air traveled, and at a distance away was this huge bellows that took several slaves to operate. And they would pump this thing up and down, and you know how the principle of heating up a furnace, like the old blacksmith furnaces and that sort of thing, that was used here in the smelting of metals. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's so mad that he wants this thing heated, and boy, these guys out there, they're double-teaming and they're working it up and down, and the whole furnace is just glowing. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar has these three Jews bound, and he has the soldiers demands to take them up there and throw them in. Well, they get there to the point to throw them in, and the heat is so intense and that the soldiers faint and die right there. I mean, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown in, but the soldiers who took them up there, just getting that close, the intense heat and lack of oxygen caused them to collapse, and they died. Well, they were bound. They had all their clothes on, and they were bound, as it describes in verse 21. And in a minute, Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. Verse 24. "And he rose up in haste." He said to his counselors, "Didn't we throw three men in there?" And they said, "Oh, that's right, King." And he said, "Well, I see we threw three men in bound, and I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire." and they have no hurt. And the form of the first is like the Son of God. Now, we're not told what it is that made Nebuchadnezzar connect the fourth being with the Son of God, but I would suppose that he was glowing brighter than the furnace. He obviously, in some way, stood out from the other three. I mean, they all evidently had similar shape and that sort of thing. It looked like four men. But there was something different about the fourth one. I suspect that he was glowing a lot brighter than anything else in there. And, you know, there was an appearance that even the king realized that this is not ordinary. Well, he gets as near as he can, and he calls out to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego very respectfully, you know, "You servants of the Most High God, come forth." And so they came forth. And the princes and the governors and the captains, the king's counselors were gathered together, and they saw the men. And the fire hadn't had any power on them. The hair of there wasn't even a singed smell. Their hair wasn't singed, even their garments. Well, Nebuchadnezzar said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants." And so he is very impressed. Well, we get into chapter 4, and we find a third factor. You find three things that are brought out, you see, to sort of humble Nebuchadnezzar. The first is the dream and the foretelling of the future all the way down to the latter days. The second is the deliverance from the fiery furnace. The fourth involves this other dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. This was a number of years later. And chapter 4 is actually something that Nebuchadnezzar himself wrote. It's incorporated in the book. He said in verse 4, "I was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace." And he had this dream that made him afraid. And he asked to have it interpreted, and the magicians and the astrologers couldn't tell him what it meant. But Daniel came in. Daniel heard about this, and he came in. And Daniel, you know, was asked, what does it mean? And this time Nebuchadnezzar tells him the dream about this great tree that grew up, and then how the he saw a holy one come down from heaven. And verse 14, "Cry aloud, say, hew down the tree, cut off the branches, shake the leaves, scatter the fruit, and let the beast get away from under it. But leave the stump, and band it with iron and brass in the tender grass of the field." And so the heart was changed from a man's heart to a beast's heart, and seven times passed over. Well, this matter is by decree of the watchers and by demand of the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. Well, Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, told what it was, and Daniel just stands here astonished because Daniel understands the implications of it, and he says, "Look, this... you know, what this means is that, verse 25, they're going to drive you from men. Your dwelling is going to be with the beasts of the field, and they'll make you eat grass like an oxen, and seven times will pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will." So then Daniel proceeded to give him some advice. He said in verse 27, "Let my counsel be acceptable unto you. Break off your sins by righteousness and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. It may lengthen your tranquility." Well, I suspect that for the next few days, you couldn't have run into a nicer fellow than old Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, he was tippy-toeing around the palace and saying please and thank you and just as nice a fellow as you'd ever want to meet. But you know what? The tendency of human nature is to get forgetful. So, you know, a few days passed by, nothing drastic happened. Week went by, month went by, And, you know, gradually this sort of fades in the king's mind because nothing drastic happens. And, you know, it's interesting. You look at things after some big disaster. I remember talking to someone who was taking a tour there in England, and they, one of the big cathedrals, and, you know, huge place, and I think they were asking the tour guide, well, you know, this is sure a vast place, vast auditorium. How many people attend church here? Well, you know, just a handful, not many. But then the tour guide, who was an older man, told them, he said, but you know, I remember once, I remember when it was full. And he was talking about the time back after the evacuation from Dunkirk. And, you know, people just all over, you know, crowding in the place. It sort of reminded me of my barber in Kilgore. We were talking, and he was a kid during World War II, and we were talking, and he brought up something similar, talked about how, you know, so many of the young men in the little community where he lived were in the Army and overseas, and talked about how they had a revival there at the little country church where he attended, and the thing was so full that they just had seats on the inside for the women and the children, and the men and the older boys had to stand up outside the windows, you know, and listen in, because it was the place was so crowded. You know, it's interesting. Seeing a disaster or something really drastic happens, people get scared. People are scared. They turn to God. But, you know, a little time goes by, and it's like then they relax, and they just sort of go back to being the way they used to. Nebuchadnezzar got all stirred up for a little bit while. But, you know, by the time you get a year down the road, see, that's where we pick up the story next in verse 29, at the end of 12 months, he's walking around, sort of strutting around, looking out, and says, is not this great Babylon that I've built for the house of the kingdom of the might of my power, for the honor of my majesty? Look what I've done, and look how great I am. You know, he built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. He was a great, impressive conqueror and builder. Oh boy, at the time he said that, a voice rang from heaven, and it said, they're going to drive, your kingdom is departed from you. And so we find that in the same hour, you know, Nebuchadnezzar just became insane, became like an animal, and was driven out, and wound up for the next 7 years roaming the fields and the forests like an animal. You know, out there until he was acting like an animal, looked like an animal. You know, where do you think some of the legends of the werewolves out howling at the moon came from? Well, I suspect that some of that probably started back here with Nebuchadnezzar. And 7 years go by. And at the end of that time, suddenly, Nebuchadnezzar lifts up his eyes to heaven and his understanding returns to him. Instead of howling at the moon, he blessed the Most High and praised and honored him that lives forever. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he does according to his will in the army of heaven among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand. Well, his reason returned, and he came back, and his glory of his kingdom was given back to him, and he was established. And so Nebuchadnezzar's point, verse 37, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride, he's able to abase. Now, the very next thing you come to is we skip forward a number of years. We skip forward to about 539 B.C. We skip forward to the time of the fall of Babylon. Now, we find that as we pick up the story with Belshazzar. Belshazzar is evidently the king's grandson. Belshazzar's mother was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, his father, Nabonidus. You know, it's interesting, the critics of course, want to dismiss Daniel. The problem they have with Daniel is that, you know, if you accept the book of Daniel, then what you find is there's a real God that can declare the future in advance. And so for a long time, they pointed out what they said were inaccuracies. They said Daniel is just sort of a romance written many years later. Well, there was no Belshazzar, and Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. Well, of course, you know, eventually archaeology caught up to them, and they found out, yes, there was a Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the co-ruler. Nabonidus was indeed the king, but Nabonidus had elevated Belshazzar to the throne as his co-ruler, and Nabonidus was elsewhere in the empire with an army, and Belshazzar was actually the one presiding in Babylon. And if they had read carefully Daniel 5 to begin with, they would have understood that, because what was the promise that Belshazzar made to Daniel? Remember, he said, whoever interprets this, dream, or this vision, or this you know, great event, he promised him that he would make him the third ruler of the kingdom. That's you know, that was the that was the promise that he made, that when Daniel was brought in, that he said, you know, the end of verse 16, you'll be the third ruler in the kingdom. Well, why would he promise him the third ruler? Well, because he himself was only the second ruler. Anyway, the answer was actually right in the text. The critics had bothered to look, but they waited until the story came out from archaeology. Now, what you find is Babylon was under siege. Cyrus had put a siege army there, but the Babylonians were so filled with pride that Belshazzar, after this siege has gone on for weeks and weeks and weeks, is actually holding a celebration to celebrate the invincibility of Babylon. Nothing can conquer us. You see, Babylon had walls that were so huge that nobody could, you couldn't begin to break them down. The Euphrates River flowed under Babylon, so they had an unlimited source of water. The area that was encompassed within the city walls was so vast, they had so much food stored up, they could outlast any siege. You couldn't break it down, and you couldn't starve them out. What were you going to do? You know, sooner or later, the army of Nabonidus will get back and deliver us. So he has this party, which very quickly degenerates into a drinking bout, and they're drinking wine to the gods of as we're told in verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone. And I suspect by the time they got down to drinking toast to the gods of wood and stone, they were pretty well sloshed. You know, they were drinking to this god and that god, and you know, after Belshazzar had gotten himself fortified a little bit, he decided to bring in the golden and silver vessels that his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. You know, boy, he really had gotten courageous now after a little while. He's going to show, you know, his greatness. And so they start doing this. And about the time they get started good using the vessels from the temple, the sacred vessels, all of a sudden a man's hand just appeared out of nowhere and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall. And the king saw, you know, it was, I'm sure he was sitting up on the, you know, the platform there, the head table, and everybody else is sitting out there, and they're all drinking. It's right in his line of vision, just where he's looking. All of a sudden, his hand just appears up there and starts writing. Well, the king's countenance was changed, verse 6. His thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. That's, I think, an interesting expression. The joints of his loins were loosed is an old King James expression. Sort of a euphemism for a sort of embarrassing accident that the king had about this point. He was absolutely scared to death. And, you know, his knees are knocking. He just, I bet you had instant silence in that place. You know, here everybody's laughing and talking and carrying on and boozing it up. And the next thing you know, they're all scared to death. And the king wants somebody to come in and interpret what this means. But they couldn't do that. And he was really troubled. And the queen, evidently the queen mother, she heard all the commotion, came in, and she said, look, verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, your ancestor, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods was found in him. And Nebuchadnezzar had made him master of the magicians and astrologers. He'll be able to interpret it. His name is Daniel. So one of the things you get the idea, you know, Daniel rose to great prominence in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, but evidently Daniel hasn't been, his services haven't been needed for a while in the aftermath of Nebuchadnezzar's service, and he's sort of been retired or put down, put aside somewhere. But the Queen Mother comes in and she says, you know, I remember a man that used to serve in the court of your grandfather, and he's the one you need. So they bring Daniel in, and the king starts making all these big promises as to what he's going to do, and make him third ruler of the kingdom. Daniel tells him, verse 17, you keep your gifts, and I'll make known what the writing is. And he said, listen, the Most High God, verse 18, gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, your ancestor, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty he gave him, all people and nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive. Whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. When his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne. He was driven from the sons of men. Until, verse 21, he knew that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he will. And you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. I think that's interesting. See, Belshazzar had heard the story. May have been old enough to have at least remembered it as a child. He'd heard the story. He was familiar with what happened. But he said, you knew all this, and you haven't humbled yourself. You've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You've brought vessels from the temple. You've showed utter contempt toward the true God, the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways, have you not glorified? So he said, this is what the writing is, and he read it, meaning, meaning, you parse it. And then he interprets it. Now let's understand these, what was the problem with this? The script that the Hebrews and the Chaldeans wrote in was the same. What we call Hebrew script today is the square Babylonian script that was used in Babylon. The words were not unknown, but they made no sense. They were written up there, meni or mina, tekel or shekel. They're different forms of the same word. You is the conjunction in Hebrew. It means and. That's why when it interprets it later on down, it refers to it as perez. You farson or you perez. And perez. So these are units of... These are weights that are measures. They're numbers. The mina, the shekel, and the perez. Now, he said, meaning, you know, this is a number. The significance of it is God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. That's a weight. See, you're weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, this is the smallest of these here. Your kingdom is divided, given to the Medes and the Persians. You know, it's like if you saw something written on the wall and it said pounds, pounds, tons, and ounces. You know what the word is. But it doesn't mean anything. I mean, if you see some mysterious thing like that written on the wall, it's even though you might be able to pronounce the word, it's meaningless in that context. And that was the problem. You know, these words are strange to us. They weren't strange to someone who spoke Chaldean or Aramaic or Hebrew. Now, we find that very night, the kingdom fell to the Medes, and Darius the Mede took the kingdom. He was 62. He was actually Cyrus's general, and Cyrus, at the point where he knew the city was going to be taken, took a portion of the army and went on elsewhere to meet Nabonidus, his army, and Darius is the one who entered. You see, how could Babylon fall? Well, very simple. What Belshazzar didn't know while he was doing all his celebrating is the armies of Cyrus had been for weeks digging a diversionary canal. That night when the sun went down, they broke the dike that was left. And when they did, the water in the channel went through, you know, the diversionary canal. And very quickly then the water level dropped under Babylon, under the walls of Babylon. And they let it drop on down until it got about knee-high. Sent some soldiers underneath the city wall, just marching through the mud. Came up on the other side while everybody's having a party, opened the gates from the inside, and next thing you know, the army had come in and just took them all by surprise. Now, let me show you something. As we look at chapters 4 and 5, we notice a connection. You know, in chapter 4, the tree is cut down and seven times pass over Nebuchadnezzar. That story is retold briefly in Daniel chapter 5, and this time we find these weights that are measures that are written there on the wall. Now, it is sort of interesting as you go through and begin to add them up, because you find when you look at at the seven times. Now, what is seven times? Well, we know that a time times and a half a time is equated with 42 months, or 1,260 days, right? Seven times is twice that much. See, 42 months is 3.5 years. 3 years is 36 months, and six more makes 42. 1,260 days, time times and a half a time, 42 months are all equated with one another. Double that, seven times would then equal 2,520 days. Now, just keep that in remembrance, and you find then when you look at the Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin that the phrase comes out here that there were 50 minas to the shekel and 25 peres to the shekel. Well, how many shekels do we have here? Well, a mina is 50 and another mina is another 50. That's 100. The shekel itself is just one, so that's 101. You add in the peres, which is 25 shekels, and you come up to 126 shekels. What does 126 shekels amount to? Well, let me show you something else. If you go back to the end of Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 27, verse 25, all your estimation shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary. 20 gerahs shall be the shekel. Well, we see that we have a list of 120, that we have a total of 126 shekels here. They're all weights that are numbers, and if you divide them down to their smallest amount, well, it's 126 shekels. But we find that there's a smaller measurement. There are 20 gerahs to the shekel. So if you got 126 shekels and you multiply it by 20 gerahs, how many gerahs do you have? 2,520. Now, that's sort of interesting. When you look at the seven times Nebuchadnezzar and you look at the the handwriting on the wall for Belshazzar. And the two incidents, remember, are connected. Daniel recounts for him the story and says, you know, you should have learned the lesson your grandfather learned. You know, it's interesting. You see, it's on sort of two levels. On one, in a literal sense, it was fulfilled in Nebuchadnezzar's lifetime. When was the tree of Babylon cut down? Well, it was cut down that night. It was cut down that night, 539 B.C., fall of 539. Come forward 2,520 years. What happens? Well, if you come forward 2,520 years, that brings you to the fall of 1982. Now, remember, the stump was banded until that time. There were bands of brass and iron, just like we're going to see the significance of that. But now, here, in the fall of 1982, very interesting series of events began in the fall of 1982. On the evening that began the Feast of Trumpets in 1982, there was a no-confidence vote in the German Bundestag that ended the tenure of the Social Democrats that had been ruling Germany. Their policy was very much an accommodation with the Russians and an acceptance of the permanent division of Europe. And they were interested in conciliating the Russians. When the vote of no confidence was taken on the evening that began the Feast of Trumpets, 2 weeks later, on the evening that began the Feast of Tabernacles in 1982, a new government was sworn in, the Christian Democrats, which was the official Roman Catholic political party of Germany, started by the Pope in the aftermath of World War II, funded by the Vatican. In Italy and Germany, when the Nazis and the fascists left, the Vatican reorganized, after they were defeated, reorganized the Christian Democrats in both of those countries, which tended then to dominate the thing. They were funded by Vatican money. That was where the Christian in the name comes from. You know, we think in terms of separation of church and state in America in a different way than they do in Europe. Well, they came to power, and there began a series of events that was very much aimed at doing something else in Europe. And exactly 7 literal times later, in the fall of 1989, is when the Berlin Wall was breached and when the communist governments of Eastern Europe fell like dominoes, and within a matter of weeks, the Iron Curtain was no more. Germany was now to be reunited, and these remarkable events that have taken place that have taken place since then. So, I think we have an interesting pattern. That's basically when the iron bands were cut and the stump began to revive. Interestingly enough, the Pope gave a speech that fall of 1982 at a Catholic shrine in Spain, where that was the speech in which he called upon Europe to unite from the Atlantic to the Urals to rediscover your roots. Well, remember what Nebuchadnezzar was told, the stump will be left in the ground, the roots will be left intact, but the tree's going to be cut down. He told Europe to rediscover their roots. What were their roots? Well, you read about them right here in Daniel 4. If you really want the roots, that's why it's called Babylon the Great. It is a revival, ultimately, of ancient Babylon in a way that is different than the predecessors. Now, at this point, the Persians have taken Babylon. Darius, of course, organizes things. Daniel, who's been sort of in semi-retirement, now gets advanced. You know, word must have traveled pretty quickly, and by the time the Persians have taken over, they've heard the story of the handwriting on the wall and Daniel. And so Daniel is given a very high position under Darius. And this produces a little bit of jealousy. And, you know, they couldn't find occasion against Daniel. They couldn't say that he was incompetent, because he was really on top of things, very capable. Couldn't say he was dishonest, because he wasn't. What are you going to accuse him of? Well, you remember the story. They came up with this crazy idea. They came to Darius and they said, look, they said, you know, you're the new king here, and people need to know how great you are and that the gods dwell in you. You ought to make a decree that nobody can pray to any god for the next 30 days except you. That'll really get everybody looking to you. Well, Darius signs this decree, and the Medes and the Persians had a particular custom, and that was what was called the law of the Medes and the Persians. Once it was said, couldn't be changed, couldn't be reversed. Because if you reverse it, then you're admitting the king made a mistake. The king doesn't make mistakes. So this was the theory behind it. Well, Daniel, when he knew the writing was signed, Daniel didn't change his practice at all. He went to his house, his windows were open toward Jerusalem, and he knelt down and he prayed three times a day, just like he always did. Well, these guys were sneaking around. They were waiting. And as soon as they caught Daniel praying, well, they ran over and told the king and said, hey, haven't you signed this decree? Well, guess what? You know, Daniel the Jew, he's praying to another god. He doesn't regard you or your decrees or your gods. Well, the king, verse 14, when he heard these words, he was sore displeased with himself. You know, at this point, he realizes how stupid he was. And he also, you know, at this point, see, his vanity's been played on. Now he realizes, you know, I was really set up. The one guy I could depend on was Daniel. These fellows are jealous of him. Now they're trying to get him in trouble. So the king tries to figure a way to get Daniel out of trouble. He labors till the going down of the sun, trying to keep figuring a way and getting more advisors and more lawyers in on the mix. But the bottom line of it was, look, the law of the Medes and the Persians. Can't be changed. So the king commanded, and they brought Daniel, and they cast him into the lion's den. And the king spoke to Daniel, and he said, your God, whom you serve, will deliver you. Brought a stone, sealed the mouth of the den, and then sealed it with his own signet. In other words, they put, you know, some sort of wax or something around the part of the edge, and he sealed it to where you could prove that it hadn't been broken. The seal wasn't broken. So he sealed it, and his lords all, they put their signet on it. So he went back to his palace, and he didn't eat that night. And he didn't, you know, take part in the entertainment, didn't allow the music to be brought in. He couldn't sleep. He was miserable. And he got up early the next morning, and he went in haste to the lion's den. And he came to the den, and he cried with a lamentable voice. You know, he had said the night before, he said, well, Daniel, I'm sure your God will take care of you. Did he really believe that? Well, no. I mean, he couldn't imagine how something like that could really work. And so he worries all night, feels terrible about how stupid he was to sign this thing, comes there with his lamentable voice, and he says, Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God, whom you serve continually, is he able to deliver you from the lions? Daniel immediately answered, said, yes, sir. You know, my God sent his angel, and he shut the lions' mouths, and they haven't hurt me, because I was innocent. Innocent to you and innocent to God. Well, the king was exceeding glad. And he commanded they bring Daniel up, and Daniel was taken out of the den, and he wasn't hurt at all, because he believed in his God. Now, here we are. You know, we started out, we saw Daniel as a young man. Now we see him as an old man. Over 60, well, just figure from 604 to 539, you're looking at what? About 65 years that have passed. So if Daniel was, let's say, 15 or 16 at the beginning of the story, he's in his early 80s at this point. So we see Daniel as a young man. We see him as an old man. And what we see at this point, Daniel believed in his God. You know, God was real to Daniel. Daniel was in far from ideal circumstances to serve God. Daniel's life had not taken the course or the direction that he would have imagined for himself. Not anything. Daniel didn't pick it out. Events happened that were beyond Daniel's ability to control. But you know the point, and I think, see, the personal level of lessons that you learn is Daniel found himself confronted by trials that he would have never chosen. But Daniel still tried to walk with God. He trusted God. He loved God. He prayed to God. He sought God. And God intervened at many times. Now, God didn't protect Daniel from everything that ever came up, but Daniel was protected in certain of these ways, and God used Daniel in a remarkable way. Used him to write part of the Bible, used him to lay out some of the most important prophetic overview of things. So, Daniel is now brought up out of the lion's den. He's not hurt. Then the king says, okay, next. All you got. Daniel prayed to his God. That worked out pretty well. You guys going to pray to me? Well, let's see how well that'll work. We're going to throw you in. And brought them and their families. And we find that the lions had mastery of them, broke their bones in pieces before they ever got to the bottom of the den. Think about it from a lion's standpoint. Daniel gets thrown in, the lions see dinner. Normally these things are, for something like this, we're going to have the lions hungry, so you don't feed them right before, you want them hungry. Well, we're told that God sent an angel and closed the lion's mouth. Can you imagine, all night long this lion is looking over here at Daniel, and he can't get his mouth open, can't even roar, Angel just, has his mouth closed. The lion is right here. One thing I can guarantee you, by the time it got daylight the next morning, there were two things you could safely say about those lions. They were hungry and they were frustrated. They were hungry, hadn't been able to open their mouth, have a bite. And they watched dinner standing in front of them the whole night through, and they couldn't get over there to him. So they were hungry and they were frustrated. And that was the mood they were in when they threw the other guys in. Well, in the meantime, of course, the angels had left. They didn't have any reason to stick around. The angels left when Daniel did. And again, see, right here at the beginning of the Persian Empire, you find that God again testified that He is the great God, the supreme ruler. It's interesting that later on, that the as you look at how God brought things to the attention of the other successor empires, very interesting. You realize that the Jews during the tenure of Alexander the Great, a decree was made that exempted the Jews from paying taxes on the sabbatical year. The story is told in Josephus as Alexander was advancing with his army and came to Jerusalem. The high priest came out to meet him to open the gates of Jerusalem. Well, the remarkable thing was the night before, Alexander had had a dream in which he had seen somebody that when he got to Jerusalem, this is who he saw. The high priest and all his vestments and everything come out, and he had had this dream. He had seen this man come to him the night before. And so he comes out. Well, Alexander's very impressed with that. And at that point, the high priest opened up the book of Daniel, and he read, told Alexander that he would be successful in his endeavor, and showed him, and said, this is written in our sacred books, and read him a portion of how that the horn of, the he-goat from Greece would smash the Medes and the Persians. Well, he was really impressed, and of course, I'm sure that the high priest was smart enough to know when to stop reading, because if you'd gone on down a few verses, you'd have read a little more. But, he told him, you'll be successful in this endeavor. And he was. And Alexander was very impressed with that, and gave favor to the Jews. So, this point is clearly made to the one who rules, and we find that Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, which was probably about 2 years, and then in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, chapter 7, we have the story, see, that sort of goes through in story flow up to chapter 6. Chapter 7 goes back and picks up the story with a series of visions. And this vision was one that Daniel had, and it was in the first year of King Belshazzar. Daniel had a dream, and he saw in this dream, he saw this stormy sea, this stormy situation, and these four great beasts, great creatures, came up out of the sea, and they were all different from one another. The first one was like a lion, had eagle's wings. Then the second was like a bear, raised up on one side, had three ribs in its mouth, and he was to arise and devour much flesh. Then he saw a leopard coming up, and it had four wings and four heads, and dominion was given. Then he saw a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth and devoured and broken pieces. It was different than the others, and it also had 10 horns. And as he was looking at the horns, there came up among them another little horn. He could see that one. And three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And this little horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. And I beheld till the thrones were cast down and the Ancient of Days did sit. And so we find that a thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. And judgment was set, and the books were open. And Daniel saw all of this, and he saw in the night visions, verse 13, one like the Son of Man, coming in the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. They brought him near before him. There was given unto him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, won't pass away. So Daniel has this vision, and it just so real, it leaves him. He's upset when it's over with. He doesn't know what it means. So then an angel comes and tells him the interpretation. He said, these great beasts, verse 17, which are four, represent four kings, or kingdoms, as we're going to see, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. And he wanted particularly to know about the fourth beast. It was different than the others. It had iron teeth and devoured and broken pieces, and had 10 horns coming up out of his head. And it had this little horn that was whose look was more stout than his fellows, verse 20. And that little horn made war against the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came. And judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the saints possessed the kingdom. And he was told, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth. And it'll be different. Tread down the earth, break in pieces, and the 10 horns of this kingdom are 10 kings that will arise. Now let's stop and think. Daniel had already seen a progression of four kingdoms, right? They started with Nebuchadnezzar, went to Persia, Greece, Rome. And finally, in the final days, that vision came down to the latter days when the God of heaven set up a kingdom that would never be removed. All those kingdoms passed away. Now Daniel sees a different vision. It's different symbols. But again, we have four kingdoms, you see. Notice here, The statement is made about the fourth beast, that verse 23, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth. Four kingdoms. Now, this fourth kingdom continues down to what? Well, the God of heaven sets up a kingdom. And the kingdom, verse 27, dominions, greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. So we have a progression of four kingdoms down to the kingdom of God. So clearly then, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, you have one of this represents one of the keys to understanding end time prophecy, understanding the book of Revelation, is Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. When you line them up together, because each tells part of the story. It's very clear from Daniel 2 where the progression starts and where it ends. Now we find these descriptions. Well, the first kingdom, the head of gold, Babylon, how is that like a lion? Well, That was, just like gold is the most precious of the metals. Here's the lion, the king of beasts. Notice that the lion stood on his feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Well, if you go back to Daniel chapter 4, you know what happened with Nebuchadnezzar, that that was part of the part of what was going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar when he became like an animal, and then when it restored, he was there, and he lifted up his eyes, and his reason returned. He was given back, in effect, the heart of a man, and instead of acting like a wild animal. So Nebuchadnezzar, this lion represented the Babylonians, the bear. Persia was known for its ponderous size, the great armies, and the three ribs in its mouth, representing the kingdoms, the three major things that they swallowed up, in terms of the three great empires of that were swallowed up. You come down to the four-headed leopard described here in Daniel chapter 7. The speed, the quickness of Alexander and his troops, and then this great, terrible creature, the Roman Empire, connected again with iron. But we find that there were 10 horns that came up, and then this little horn. And the little horn was different than the others. It was in some ways like them. It was a horn, but it will arise after them in the sense of behind them. As Daniel sees the horns, and then he back behind them, he sees this little horn. That's the sense of it. And it was different. It was responsible for subduing the first three. And verse 25, this little horn would speak great words against the Most High, wear out the saints of the Most High, think to change times and laws, and they'll be given into his hand for time, times, and a dividing of a time. And really what you're looking at, see, what emerged out of the old Roman Empire? Well, the 10 horns can be traced from the fall of the Roman Empire on down. But there was a little horn. There was another kingdom. There was, for all of the political kingdoms that came up, there was a little kingdom that came up. It was different. Its look was more stout than his fellows. It lasted in a way that they didn't. It was small in terms of territory. You're looking at the papacy. You're looking at the Vatican. That's the one that has... they're still there all this time. And they're the ones that spoke great swelling words against the Most High, launched persecutions and inquisitions against the saints, and think to change times and law. Well, who did that? Where did Christmas come from? Where did Easter come from? Where did Sunday come from? Well, you go back. Catholic Encyclopedia won't try to tell you that it comes out of the Bible. They'll tell you that they did it by their authority. And they were responsible for, so you have this story. Now, we don't have time to go into a lot more detail, but you can go back and review it in the Beast booklet. But these things set the stage that as we come beginning in chapter 7, We continue through this series of visions Daniel was given about end-time prophecy. There is a gap, approximately 400 years or 450 years in terms of the Bible, when the last book was written to when the story starts. From the let's say the book of Malachi until the birth of Christ is about 400 years. That story is not, of those 400 years, is not left out. It's told by way of prophecy in the book of Daniel. You see, you read about the Babylonians, that was extant. Then you read about the Persians, you read about the Greeks, you read about the Romans, you read about the story, because even during that time when God was not sending prophets, the story had already been told. Now, there's some really interesting things we're going to look at in the closing part of the book of Daniel, and I've got study questions to give you now that we'll go over the rest of that next Bible study. So with that, we'll be, and I might just mention that you may want to, for background, to go back and reread the booklet on the Beast of Revelation, because it will, just by necessity of going through this, we'll have to go through it rather rapidly, but if you get the background on it, it'll help you put it together. So let's pass out the questions here for the next time.